Dakota has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com, RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Masters of the Dark Arts. I'm not quite sure that's a label we were expecting to place on Norwich City at any stage during this season. But alas, after a 1-0 win at Watford, it is the label that they've been given. And we will delve into that and a whole lot more from what was a spicy, as a former Norwich City head coach would describe it, game at Vicarage Road on Saturday, which the Canaries emerged from as 1-0 victors. This is the Pinkin.com Norwich City podcast, brought to you in association with First Bus. I'm your host, Connor Southwell, joined by Paddy Davitt and Samuel Seaman, who are on their best behaviour. No dark arts, no housery, nothing like that. We're all going to be very well behaved as we reflect on an afternoon that was very pleasant from a Norwich City perspective. I think when you are watching a head coach orchestrate celebrations in front of a away end, you're watching a hard-fought 1-0 victory, albeit with a team that had 10 men, and you end with an opposition manager who feels particularly aggrieved about the whole situation, along with your team and some of your players. And I think if you're a Norwich City fan, that makes for a pretty perfect recipe. Paddy, there's so much to reflect on, and we will do that, and we'll dissect all of the various controversies and maybe all of the elements that did perhaps upset some of the Watford camp on Saturday. But as a result, as a victory, as momentum for Norwich City, 5-8 now, they're in a good place at the minute.
They certainly are. Do you know what? Before we get started, this only work on anybody watching the podcast, we're all actually wearing dark clothing, and that hasn't been planned in any way to continue that theme. But we all seem to have gone down the path of tapping into the dark. I mean, it was funny, Norwich were in the dark kit as well, weren't they? So it was almost, it was inevitable, really, that it was going to be something related to the tone of the colours. But I'm on a serious matter, Connor. I've just had a look. I saw somebody on Twitter earlier in the day and I thought that can't be right. I've just checked. Now, 2 points out of the top six, eighth in the table, and 5 of the next 7 at Carr Road, and a bar Blackburn in that run, all the other six bottom half teams. So that isn't to get carried away and then start planning the open top bus tour. But what I think it does do is create a path and the conditions to build on what we saw at Watford and what we saw against Swansea. And of course, with a fair wind in terms of no more injuries and no more suspensions, Slimani, Nunes, Jurasek, and Borja Sainz to drop into this mix. You know, we don't need to get carried away, but that feels like some favourable currents flipping back round behind Norwich rather than what has felt sort of through that festive period for various reasons on and off the pitch was maybe a season was just getting away from them a little bit, and we were upping the ante about the transitional element. I think we can maybe just dial that down a touch now after the last two games and what's to come and the players that are available, hopefully, over the horizon and start to talk in the here and now a little bit more, because 30 games, 29 games in for some, you're 2 points out of the playoffs are on, let's be honest. So that is maybe the madness of the Championship that we lurch from. Well, nobody said it was going to be anything other than a transitional season to bring it on now. I mean, you look at fifth and sixth for me as well within their compass in terms of the points differential. Hopefully we're not the other side of these 7 games and, oh, they've missed an opportunity and it's back to transitional. But in the here and now, let's enjoy it, let's live it, and let's look forward now with some optimism, I think, because for all those reasons I've stated, the path is there now for Norwich to really sustain a top six push.
Yeah, it's a hell of an opportunity that they've got ahead of them. Particularly, I mean, even in the shorter term, looking ahead to the next two games, a Carrow Road doubleheader, Derby, who are, I think, on a run of seven straight defeats, eight if you include the FA Cup, and Preston themselves, who have struggled this season, but are a little bit more solid under Paul Heckingbottom. They've got a good opportunity to get a decent points haul, and we'll come on and speak about that later. And Sam, look, we're going to get into all of the elements that irked maybe Tom Cleverley and the Watford end, but I almost want to strip that away for a minute because I think it can and perhaps has to an extent got lost. But I think particularly first half, maybe less so second half, and I think maybe we'll debate the second half in a little bit more detail a little bit later in the show. But certainly the first half, Norwich were dominant. They created the better opportunities. They probably should have been leading by at least a goal by the time Bayo was sent off. They should have probably been leading by two by the time the halftime whistle came. That was, you know, and we've spoken a lot about their difficulties on the road. That was a very pleasing away performance, wasn't it? Even probably if you do throw in the second half, which I think maybe wasn't particularly great.
Yeah, I think it's easy when you go away to Watford and win 1-0 and there's a bit of refereeing controversy to say that it's a sort of typical away performance or that, you know, those dark arts did get Norwich over the line. But I thought, yeah, especially in the first half, it was a bit closer to what we've seen at Carrow Road in terms of the tactical approach and how they were able to do what they want to do under Johannes Hoftorup, basically, away from home to a greater extent than they have been able to for the rest of the season. I still thought probably at times in that first half, they lacked a bit of quality in and around the box. They lacked maybe that creative player in those attacking midfield areas to just play that quality final pass at times. They obviously missed a couple of chances before they opened scoring as well. But I thought overall it was a very good away performance and certainly more proactive than maybe we've seen on the road in recent weeks and months. I thought their pressing was really good. They seemed to be much higher up the pitch than they have been at times. They won the ball actually really well in some of those situations. And then they did have the quality when they were progressing the ball up the pitch. There wasn't that sort of Portsmouth pragmatism that we saw. There wasn't the desire to play long balls on a regular basis. It was that sort of football playing through the thirds and on the floor and out from the back that created those opportunities for them and gave them the chances to seize the initiative. But yeah, as you mentioned, you know, the second half wasn't flowing whatsoever. It wasn't really that entertaining, and strangely, it felt like Norwich were probably better against 11 men than against 10. But I think when you look at that, you have to consider Watford, who, to be fair, I thought were quite good, and the way that they dealt with losing a player was quite good. They didn't try to be overly ambitious and try to press particularly aggressively once they had lost a man. They sort of picked their battles and did that quite well, and then sort of countered pretty well on Norwich as well. So you have to consider their performance and the fact that they dealt with that quite well. But yeah, I can see why there would be concerns over the second half. But still, when you compare the performance to what Norwich have produced away from home this season, I thought it was really encouraging, not only because of the result, of course, being their fourth win away from Carrow Road all season, but also just the performance, because I thought it was much closer to the identity they're trying to build than maybe they have produced in away games so far.
Yep, agreed. And, you know, I think before we get into the pantomime, which we're going to engage in just a moment, it's important to make that point, because I think we'll come on to particularly Tom Cleverley, but maybe what has been lost is actually in that first half, you know, there's been so much debate in recent weeks about shots on target. You look at the quality of chances that Norwich created, obviously created an excellent one inside 65 seconds, didn't they, for Josh Sargent, who somehow, not quite sure how, managed to put the ball in probably the only place that wouldn't have resulted in a goal and straight at Jonathan Bond. But even after that, some of the quality of their football, some of the chances that they created, some of the openings that they worked was all really positive. So I wanted to start with that, really, because I think it's a point that shouldn't be lost. But equally, of course, we are going to have to talk about the dark arts. And now it wouldn't be fitting, I don't think, for me to really come on and explain what the dark arts are, as I'm sure it wouldn't be for you, gents. But thankfully, I've managed to find someone who I think describes it pretty well. Have a listen to this.
People think, oh, Man City, yeah, fantastic football team. But their players are not only the best footballers, they're the best at the dark arts of the game.
So what are the dark arts?
Clever fouls, time wasting, set pieces you would introduce when someone's about 17, 18.
I mean, it's nicely. Is that good?
It is a massive part of the game. At the end of the day, you've got 11 players trying to stop you win, and they're going to be doing it. People think, oh, Man City, yeah, fantastic football team, but they're playing.
That's played twice. But that's a brilliant, I think, summary of what the dark arts are. Well, funny enough, it's a Mr. T Cleverly, and he is speaking on a podcast last year, I believe, which is the Business of Football podcast. And look, I think he's bang on in that assessment. It is a really important part of the game. And it's interesting to know what Tom Cleverly felt of Mr. T Cleverly's assessment of the dark arts after the game yesterday, Paddy.
Well, listening to that clip, I think he'd have been very, very pleased with the application of those so-called dark arts. If a dark art is effectively ensuring you manage the game in your favour to get to a point where you end up on the right side of the result, then he seemed to be talking up that as a positive and something that is part of every professional's toolkit. What was it? You get taught it when you're 17 or 18 or whatever. So maybe he forgot what he was taught at Manchester United when he was 17 or 18 for that 90 minutes prowling the Watford touchline yesterday. I think you hit the nail on the head last night when we were interacting and you said nobody's talking about that was a seventh defeat in nine for Tom Cleverley's Watford today or last night. So whether there's a bit of deflection going on there or a large dose of deflection, who knows? Because he's from seemingly putting them in playoff contention, maybe the reverse of hopefully where Norwich are going now. They're slipping and they've gone below Norwich now in the table. I wouldn't call them... There wasn't the most vociferous fan protests I've ever encountered inside or outside a stadium, but there was a Watford-esque kind of almost apologetic show of lights from mobile phones about the 70th minute mark and a few chants directed towards, I think it's the Pozzo operation there. They're clearly not happy. There was this bizarre club account tweets supporting Tom Cleverley around their previous game at Coventry, I think it was. So from afar, it looks like a club that aren't quite all singing together on the same hymn sheet and pulling in the right direction. And along come Norwich in a positive sense from a Norwich perspective and continue that and prolong that sense of frustration. I think a lot of his comments, I think a lot of some of the reaction from the fan base there is dipped in frustration about all those elements that they can see a season getting away from them. They're not happy maybe with the ownership, the direction of travel. And then they see, obviously, you know, probably more evidence of that on a championship playing field, that they're probably not good enough to be in the top six come the end of the season. And that manifests itself in believed or imagined, but a sense that it wasn't their failings why they lost that game yesterday to Norwich City. It was a combination of woeful officiating / Norwich's application of elements that every team up and down the land will use to a greater or lesser extent. And Tom Cleverley himself in that clip suggesting that, you know, even a team as good as they have been, dominant wise in English football as Man City, employed the dark arts. So it's good enough for Pep. It's good enough for Johannes and Norwich, I would say.
Yes, indeed. And we'll obviously come on to, excuse me, the individual decisions in a moment, Sam. But he seemed particularly irked by Emi Marcondes and some of his antics. Now, I've had a look at the numbers this morning. I've got them in front of me. And, you know, I think the exact words, in fact, I'll try and get the exact words now in terms of what he described of them. But essentially implying that I think Emi Marcondes was buying free kicks and was going down particularly readily. Let me see if I can find him. I'm scrolling down on his quotes now. So that's around the particular incident. But yeah, he said, Marcondes is a kind of player who will do those sort of things and it's disappointing. But I'm living and learning in my coaching career and I'm sure he will do the same. Well, it's interesting because obviously there was the flashpoint of the red card, which we'll get into at the moment. But actually, you take that out of it. In terms of being fouled, Emi Marcondes was fouled three times yesterday in the whole 90 minutes. That's the same amount for context as Kellen Fisher. So I don't know why Kellen Fisher maybe hasn't been subjected to the same level of, call out that Emi Markonis has received. And I mean, interestingly, from a Watford perspective, Imran Loser, he was fouled the same amount of times as Emi Markonis as well. So again, is he a really good applicator of the dark arts? I think it's a really interesting one as to why Emi Markonis seems to have particularly irked him.
Yeah, I think it probably does come purely down to that red card decision, which, as you said, we'll come on to it. But he clearly wasn't very happy with. And I think that may well have tarnished his opinion of Emi Markonis for the rest of the game. Now, whether that was particularly important to Markonis or how desperate he is to be liked by Tom Cleverley, I suppose we'll never find out. But it does feel like that's mainly just been taken from the red card situation, because although he's somebody who I know the Norwich fans love for his passion and his desire to win, and that's certainly something that we've seen every time he's played for the club, really, since he arrived in October, I'm not sure I've ever thought of him as a spectacularly sort of discreet user of the dark arts, if we're going to use that term again. So I was a little bit surprised to hear that. But what I found particularly strange was the idea that referees need to be sort of researching different players and knowing the players going into the games, which I would have thought would actually be the opposite of what managers and head coaches would want. I'd have thought that they'd want the referees going in there with no prejudice. If the glove was on the other hand, and you had him going in thinking Loza was somebody who likes to buy fouls and wants to employ these dark arts, and then he ends up getting a yellow card or a red card, and the referee admits that to Cleverley, then I think Cleverley's probably absolutely raging about that. So that was the part of it that I particularly was surprised by. But also, and maybe I'm missing something, but I've never thought of Markonis as somebody who does readily throw himself down or does that more than the average player. I think he's just somebody who is desperate to win games, was very good for Norwich yesterday. And unfortunately for him in the short term and Watford in the long term, was on the end of what I thought was a clear red card. So I think that's probably where Cleverley's got it from, because having watched almost every minute that Markonis has played for Norwich, I'm not sure I've really seen that side to his game, to be honest.
No, I agree. And that's probably a nice place to pick it up from in terms of that red card. I mean, Sam, you said it was a clear red card. I would agree. I think from the first moment that I've watched it, my view hasn't really changed. I've watched it a few times from a lot of different angles. I don't see how anyone can watch that, the same footage that we've seen, and come to the conclusion that it's not a red card. And look, you can argue about Emi Markonis putting his body into him beforehand, and you can justify whether that's right or wrong. It happens probably at every set piece, to be honest. But when a player turns around and has that intent and that force and that and is so deliberate in terms of inflicting a movement onto an opponent, I don't see, Paddy, in what other world that could not constitute violent conduct, really.
Exactly. No, none at all. Funny enough, because he's no stranger to disciplinary matters this season, Kenny McLean, I was trying to think of the game where, very similarly, at a corner, he's kind of almost grappling with a player and lashed out in the eyes of the officials, straight red. And I found it. Luton, Carrow Road, October 2022. They lost the game 1-0. It was in front of the Barclay.
Norwich appealed that as well.
They did. And I don't think they were successful, were they, from my memory? But bookend those two incidents, that one with McLean 2 or 3 years ago and the one we saw Saturday, identical in terms of the state of the game, in terms of the actual incident and in terms of the outcome from the officials. For me, you know, they got it right with Kenny McLean back in October 22, and they got it right yesterday. And to be fair, too cleverly, In and amongst the deflection tactics, he said, no, I can't excuse what Bio did there. He's let his teammates down. He shouldn't have reacted like that. Then he goes on to, maybe wrap lots of, in his view anyway, mitigation around Markonis' reaction. But I'm not sure that Tyson Fury stays up from that sort of straight arm to the throat, upper chest area. You know, it was quite a forceful push out. So I'm not buying that, the inference from Cleverley that Markonis is, took that blow and then just collapsed to the floor and then rolled around. I think that would have been anybody watching that from a neutral perspective wouldn't have seen that interpretation. So, yeah, case closed. It's a red card.
Yeah, agreed. I mean, he thinks it's going to get overturned, Paddy.
I was just going to make that point. I say that, but then in that press conference, by the end, he said, we've seen an angle and we will present that as part of our appeal and it will be overturned. We hope it is. It will be overturned. So I'm going to be very closely watching the FA spokesperson's X feed over the coming days or so just to see how that one plays out.
Yeah, if Kenny McLean's against QPR is worthy of a free game ban, then goodness knows where they're going to end up with that one. Sam, let's go on to the other controversial incident that the hosts weren't happy about. And before half time, the penalty shout that they had, Angus Gunn. Initially, I mean, I'm trying to sort of paint the picture for people. So the press box that we had a TV up above us. To be honest, we might as well not have done. It was so grainy. It wasn't of a high quality. They showed one replay of it pretty tight in, probably the angle that people watching from home would have seen. And I think without the quality on the screen that we had, initially it did look like he'd sort of clipped his leg. But actually you watch clearer replays and I think it becomes pretty apparent pretty quickly that he got the ball. So, you know, I'm not sure if they will come to the same conclusion, but that for me felt like probably the right decision.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you could actually see in real time, and I felt in real time that he'd got there because Chatvatadze takes a pretty loose touch, and at that point it feels like Gunn is probably the favourite. And then as you're watching it, it looks like the ball stops, which obviously doesn't happen unless Gunn gets a touch on it. I thought in real time it was quite clear. He stops it and then Chatvatadze touches it again and it goes behind for what was rightly given as a goal kick. I think Cleverley actually said post-match, and when you consider how angry he was about the refereeing performance, I think he said it was sort of 50-50 and you couldn't make a decision on it. So I think when you have the opposition head coach saying that, that probably does indicate that it wasn't a penalty and that actually it was a very well-timed challenge from Angus Gunn at a really important juncture in the game for Norwich, just about going into half-time. Obviously, there was another complication with that when Cleverley said that he felt Gunn had sort of exaggerated the situation.
Yeah, I mean, he's accused him of feigning injury, hasn't he? I think that's a really dangerous road to go down if you're going to start going down that road. That probably, on a serious point, as much as we've maybe been slightly jovial around his comments, that is like that's just not on, really, is it, to be accusing players of faking injury?
Yeah, it's also a situation where it's quite clear how someone could get injured. He's sliding in with his face basically right next to the, you know, somebody who's sprinting. Their boots are right there next to his face. It's not unimaginable at all or hard to work out how somebody could get injured in that situation. So I thought that was certainly quite harsh, but he clearly wasn't in a very good mood post-match. But yeah, again, that for me is basically as clear as the red card. No penalty. And yeah, I thought the ref got that one right as well.
And finally, Paddy, the one that maybe irked Johannes Hoftorup in equal measure. Josh Sargent gets played through. He's going, I think he's going to drive in the box. He's going to have a shot on goal. He gets brought down by Ryan Andrews. Your thoughts, feelings on that one? Should that have been another red card?
I haven't, in all honesty, seen too many replays of it subsequently. But in real time, you know, is the only debate, because I don't think the ball, a lot of the time they talk about, well, that final touch before the impact is so far away, are they going to recover it? I don't think that would have been mitigation from a Watford perspective. It, for me, it's simply, is there players around on the cover? Or would they... players got round on the cover. There is a Watford defender in the vicinity, but it felt like a red. Watching it in real time, Johannes was adamant. He thought it was a red. And that's why he was pushing back when he was asked for his opinion on the bio one. He said red with an S on the end because he wanted to link the two together. So maybe one went for Watford and one went against Watford in that regard. If I'm honest, I can't say definitively, having not really watched it back. You boys might be able to chip in, but
I've seen it. So Matty Pollock is in the vicinity, as you say, and initially that was kind of my thought process, that was he on the cover, but I think he's actually behind play, so I don't think he is covering. I don't think he is getting there. So in that on that basis, it is a denial of a goal-scoring opportunity. It should be a red card. Equally, I can understand why, maybe from the referee's position, as he's looking at it and he's seeing a Watford defender scrambling to get back, he is behind play, but he's not so drastically behind play. It's clear and obvious. I think he's in the picture enough. So I think you could probably create an argument that, you know, without the benefit of a VAR or of a replay, that you could make the case that maybe he felt he was going to get back and recover. I don't think he was. So I kind of have sympathy as to why he didn't give the red card. And, you know, let's be honest, I think maybe the way the game had gone, the atmosphere and all of those elements probably play into that factor as well. But other than that, I don't really see what else there is to be hugely upset about, Sam, in terms of... Oh, sorry, Pad, if you want to come back in. You're on mute, mate.
I was just going to throw in, Connor, having been on in the Cleverly presser, he did then also add, if you remember, very late in the game, Tom Ince, when he burst past Kellen Fisher. And
the dive.
And went down, after he'd already clear air had gone past him and Kellen Fisher. He seemed to think that, that the clip had happened and he tried to stay on his feet and gone down. So, you know, that was another, you asking the bones of contention. That seemed to be one that he offered up anyway.
Right. I think if anyone sees that and comes to that conclusion, I can't really help them, I'm afraid. It was maybe the best bit of simulation I've seen at Vicarage Road since Wes Hoolahan got that penalty in about 2015. But other than that, I'm not sure, Sam, that there's too much more from a refereeing perspective that you can really pinpoint and say that he got hugely wrong. I mean, he was no better nor no worse than I think probably most of the Championship officials that we've seen this season.
Yeah, I think that's probably fair. I mean, there are always going to be decisions that you disagree with, and it does feel like inconsistency on some of the smaller decisions in terms of how much contact it takes to get a foul. That seems to be quite a constant theme throughout the Championship. But I also have sympathy with the referees, especially with those small decisions, because they have to make 100 plus every game, and you're never going to get all of them right. But mainly what you want is for the referees to get those big decisions right. And I thought, if you throw the Ince one in as well, that he got 3 out of 4 right, because I think the Sergeant one probably should have been a red card as well. And probably a 75% rate is better than we've seen from most of the referees in Norwich's games this season. So, yeah, overall, I didn't think it was really a bad performance at all. But when you're a head coach under pressure, you've lost 1-0 and you've gone down to 10 men fairly early on, I think it's easy to see where maybe you go with your comms. So, I wasn't surprised to see the response. And of course, you know, we're all as football fans emotional as well. So I could see why maybe some of the Watford fans felt that way too. But just trying to look at it a little bit more analytically, I actually thought an above average refereeing performance for what we've seen across the Championship this season. Even if it wasn't perfect, and of course you can pick holes when there are that many decisions made. But I'd probably, if you offered me that quality of refereeing performance from now until the end of the season, I think I'd probably take that.
Yeah, I would agree with that assessment completely. And like you say, I think there is probably and Paddy referenced it earlier as well. There is a point to be made in terms of, you know, the fact that nobody and we're probably guilty of it because we've spent the last sort of 10, 15 minutes debating these decisions, but nobody now is talking about Watford's run of form and how, you know, badly they've sort of off the boil. They're obviously speculation, as Pad said earlier as well, regarding his position as late as last week. So you can understand why maybe he's taken it down that path. I don't necessarily agree with the way that he's done it, but that's, you know, that's not for me to agree or disagree with, really, Paddy. But I mean, you were just finally on this, because and on a slightly lighter note, I mean, you were obviously in Cleverley's press conference yesterday, and I'm guessing you would have been in the infamous Chris Wilder press conference back in the day as well, where he was particularly aggrieved around bus drivers and whatnot. So if you had to compare the two, I mean, which one are you rating as the greater theatrical performance?
Oh, Mr. Wilder all day long. I mean, that's gold. To weave in the coach driver as a reason why you've lost the game, I thought was, I don't know, it was in years to come, that managers on the LMA courses should be, when they do the modules about post-match interviews and deflection tactics, you want to throw that one in as a case study, I think. Bravo.
Exactly. And that is the league table that we will use, the Chris Wilder bus driver barometer of opposition managers. But, you know, it probably is a compliment in there in terms of how Norwich wants. And Paddy, in fairness, Johannes, I felt probably dealt with it quite well when you put some of Cleverley's comments to him, which I think he was aware of before he walked into the room.
Just going to make that point. Yeah. I didn't want to betray any confidences, but basically the mechanics of it yesterday was Cleverley came into the rather plush auditorium where the managers do their post-match.
Which is quite rare, isn't it? Because usually it's the visiting manager who goes first.
Yeah, now whether that was, that is normally the convention. Yeah, because obviously the theory being that they've got a bit of a journey ahead of them and get them on the road. But we'll leave that there. It was definitely Tom Cleverley walked through. And I think Johannes referenced it in one of his answers. In fact, it was the answer to my question about, you know, for him to come back on those quotes, the dark art accusations towards his players. He said he'd spent many minutes waiting outside while Tom was speaking. So, I've had it told to me that in those many minutes, he was getting relayed, probably from our tweets, exactly what was being said. So, it wasn't a bolt out of the blue when he was asked the question. He knew the topic was coming. And, and I thought he... quite rightly, you know, it's not really for opposition managers to be talking about other teams' players. I don't really see, you know, it's a disrespect for me that, and he wasn't going to go down that route. Having said that, I'm pretty sure by the time we speak to him again, which will be back end of this coming week prior to the derby, he will have watched rather than had it relayed to him what Tom Cleverley has said. So let's see if he's got a slightly different view, because, you know, if I'm him and him in charge of my group of players and I've had to sit and watch an opposition manager be quite cutting. We've talked about the Angus Gunn line, the persistent line towards Emi Marcondes, and then the collective accusation towards his players. I think I probably would want to push back on that. So we'll see if he's as diplomatic in a few days' time. I probably would have backed him to be, but knowing him, there'll probably be a backhanded cutting comment in there in his while he's saying, I'm not going to get involved in that. He normally then throws in a nice punch to the gut underneath. Metaphorically.
Yeah, it has been known. Right, let's move on then from late bus drivers to bus drivers you can rely on. This is our first bus segment, Just the Ticket. We are picking out individuals, and I think we've probably got a nice sort of pool to pick from today. So I think we can probably all go slightly separately. Sam, let's start with you. From that 1-0 win at Vicarage Road, who was Just the Ticket for you and why?
Yeah, I think it's an easy one, but I'm going to go Lucien Mahovo, who I actually thought was probably the best player on the pitch. Definitely for me, Norwich's best player on the afternoon. Basically, everything that I said about him following the win over Swansea last weekend, you can copy and paste and put it here. But it's maybe even more impressive the fact that he's playing against Moussa Sissoko, who's obviously played in the Champions League final. He's away from home in an atmosphere that was quite hostile, especially after some of those refereeing decisions. And he's just played basically as if it was a few months ago, and he's playing for the under-21s at Colney, and there are 50, 100 people in attendance. He doesn't seem to be fazed by anything that's going on around him at all, despite the fact that, you know, he's only had two championship starts and the last senior game he started before that was on loan at Boston United. So, again, just took everything really, really well in his stride, did everything with quality and had both the defensive and attacking sides to his game, which I think a lot of people would have you believe is impossible from the modern fullback, especially somebody of his age. But, you know, defensively, he has that physical presence. He knows where to be one-on-one. He's pretty solid as well. And then we've all seen, and Johannes has talked quite a lot as well about the quality that he has in the final third and when he gets on the ball. And I think we saw that as well. So right now, it feels like that's basically his position to lose. And within two championship games, he's pretty much nailed it down. And I think that's deserved because, yeah, for me, again, he was the best player on the pitch yesterday.
Yeah, bang on. It's been... With him, it's funny because sometimes you get young players and they need a little bit of building up and they need to be sort of you know, sent out on loan and they need to build up. With him, he's just been dropped in and almost it's like plug in and ready to go. And he looks basically, you know, ready to thrive at the level. He's taking it all in his stride. I think the second game, you know, you make your first senior debut and you're sort of fueled by adrenaline and nervous energy. The second one can almost be a little bit of a hangover. But the fact, you know, and you mentioned it, the fact that he stepped into it with so much confidence, so much quality. I thought the three best moments that Norwich created in the first half, he had a hand in all of them, really. The cross for Sargent, obviously somehow contorting his body to get on the end of that deflected Emi Marcondes free kick. Such a shame that didn't go in, because what a moment that would have been for the young man, albeit, you know, we'll accept Josh Sargent tapping it in. That's also fine. And obviously that crossfield ball to Oscar Schwartau, which he put basically on the end of his toe. It was a wonderful bit of technique. There are others within there as well. But yeah, just a really composed performance. And of course, he was playing against Moussa Sissoko, I think, who has 295 Premier League appearances and transfer fees of over 30 million in his career. I mean, that's a proper player to test yourself up against. And yeah, he was excellent. Paddy, let's come to you next. Who was just the ticket for you?
I am tempted to throw in Emi Marcondes, but I'll avoid that and go because he does get a bit of a bad rap. But Jakob Sorensen, I thought, to come in there, that was his second start since October the 27th last year. We know the injury situation with him. We know that's kind of, you know, if his Norwich career stopped yesterday, I think most people would associate with him those prolonged periods where maybe his body hasn't been robust enough to give him the opportunity to show what he showed again yesterday. And he has shown periodically when he does get runs in the team. And this is maybe the frustration that parts of the fan base have with him, that you keep him fit, you keep him healthy, and there is no doubt at this level there's a player in the right setting and maybe that Norwich don't have enough of, you know, in terms of that midfield mix. And I thought he blended very well with McLean. Those two allowed Marcondes that licence to get a bit further forward. That worked very well as a free. And I mean, that big chance from Sargent in the second minute, that was actually Sorensen who played in Mahovo, and he popped up on the edge of the box. So although I'm talking about him in terms of more his ability to sort of just put out fires, there was one incident where in the first half, Duffy turns the ball over in a dangerous position. He's got back near post and cut out across. You know, that experience to know the position and know where he needs to be. Yeah, it'll fly under the radar, obviously, with Mahovo, clearly, and Sargent, again, with a goal. And Marcondes, you know, was good in all seriousness. But, you know, you need some glue in and amongst, you know, the players who are going to grab the headlines in a performance like that yesterday. And he offered that. Now, the reality is, obviously, with Slimani and with Nunes very close, we hope, to being back in contention, he may find his limited opportunities in terms of starts. So, you know, it was good. Maybe he just served a little reminder that if you needed to call on him down the stretch between now and May and he's fit and he's healthy, I don't think he would let you down. But, you know, nobody is obviously hyping him up to probably dislodge Nunes, McLean and Slimani from the midfield three if all three of those were available. But one thing is for sure, you know, there is a reasonably good championship operator. Nobody's going to say he's going to ever rip up the league and, you know, drag Norwich into places where a Sargent might take them or Sainz took them in the first half of the season. That's not his game. That isn't what he's about. But he is a very, you know, reliable operator when, to keep harbouring the point, you know, when his body allows him to be. And that is obviously the fear now, that between now and the end of the season, we're not talking about Jakob Sorensen's impact on the pitch, but about him being unavailable again. And contractually as well, he probably does need to be fit and available if he's going to get another, you know, option in terms of his contract status, which is, as it stands, he's out of contract, isn't he, at the end of this summer.
Yeah, stability, isn't it? That's what he offers when he's fit and available, which is why I think he probably ends up playing a constitution of positions, because he's able just to take a role and doesn't do it. You know, he's not going to be a man of the match contender every week, but he's just a steady Eddie, and he ticks along nicely. And yeah, I think some of that composure in possession was really useful. And particularly, you can see the scenario certainly away from home where they do need a bit more of a solid base and a little bit more protection alongside Kenny McLean. He offers them that as well. So yeah, I agree. I thought he was good yesterday. I mean, we could obviously throw a couple in. Josh Sargent clearly obviously won the game for them again. Oscar Schwartau, I thought was good again, but I'm going to go for Kellen Fisher, the other fullback. I thought he was good as well. Really, you know, we mentioned Mahovo, really nice sort of story there. You've got two fullbacks who, as late as 2023, were both playing non-league football. And yeah, he was technically good. I thought he dealt with a very difficult opponent pretty well. And of course, obviously stepping in midfield as well and showing some of those technical qualities that he has really enables Norwich in possession. And yeah, maybe after a little bit of a fight back from Jack Stacey in recent weeks, it feels like that was a pretty good response. Obviously, he got taken off last weekend at half time. That was fitness related rather than anything tactical. But Jack Stacey came on and really produced a good performance. So for Torup to keep the faith with him and to be rewarded in that way, I think was pretty pleasing from his perspective. Just a very intelligent, capable footballer. And I think the amount of trust and responsibility that Torup is giving him this season, it sort of shows how highly he rates him. So yeah, I thought Callum Fisher was very, very good yesterday. We could, of course, name, I think, a lot of other players in that Norwich City 11. That's always the best place to be in this sort of situation. So there we go. That is the Just the Ticket segment, of course. You can let us know who was yours. If you're watching on YouTube, you can comment it down below. You can obviously get in touch on socials or any of that good stuff. It's always good to hear from you guys as well. Before we come on to transfers and deadline days and all of that shenanigans, Paddy, it was the first time I think we've seen this end of the game, the away end, who I thought were excellent yesterday. Actually, you know, I've been not underwhelmed, but I think it's not always been the case that the atmospheres have been great in some of the away ends at Norwich City games this season. But from the warm up, there was a burst where the players sort of ran towards them to sort of run through some cones. That's not the technical term for it, but that's what they were doing. Just sort of sprints before they headed inside, and there's a real roar from that sort of 2,000 strong away end. And then at the end of the game, where the players went over and celebrated, they wanted that moment with Yohannes Hoftorup, who, as he said to you, was very reluctant to do it. But it did feel like a moment, didn't it? I mean, you have to go back to, you know, and we obviously Daniel Farke did it pretty famously, but certainly Dean Smith never got that, or the fans never wanted that of Dean Smith. David Wagner's were a lot more orchestrated. That felt sort of organic and natural. And, you know, for all of the sort of elements of the strategy that we speak about regularly and recruitment and playing style, there is that need for connection as well. And it felt like a moment really between him and that fan base, even if he wasn't particularly fond of doing it.
No, he definitely wasn't. No, I mean, I worked the quotes up. We're recording it Sunday afternoon, but anybody now watching or listening, go to the Pinkton and you will read exactly what he said. Yeah, I mean, he said he has two pet hates in football. One is that his individuals being singled out for awards and, you know, praise.
He loved just the ticket segment.
Oh yeah, he'd be all over that. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And the other one is the environment he found himself in, which is at the end of a game, an individual being singled out, because for him, link the two together, it's about the team, it's about the team environment. He talked about then broadened out his answer to, he has these mad crazy ideas, but he needs his coaches to work all hours to try and, you know, get to the bottom of whatever ideas he's come up with. So in other words, it's the team around him. And I don't know, I didn't press him on it, but it felt like maybe there was some sort of, I don't know, internal thing with the players that they said, oh, if we win here today, you've got to go and do that. Because there was a good picture actually of him trying to wrestle Josh Sargent to go and share the limelight with him as the match winner, and Sargent wasn't having a bit of it. So I don't know whether there was a little bit of interplay there behind closed doors where
it just kind of felt to me like the players almost wanted him to have it, and I think they maybe recognised that was what the fans wanted rather than than Josh Sargent.
But if he's expressed that he doesn't want that, you know, you could imagine how the players would think, oh, we'll put the gaffer in a bit of a tight spot here kind of thing. That's the sort of banter you get, don't you, in those environments. But I mean, he did do it, but I'd be surprised if we see that again, because, as I say, everything in response to that question was, yeah, I didn't like it, didn't enjoy it. Sometimes you have to be out of your comfort zone, but the next time it'll be all of us going to the fan base, whether it's an away game or a home game. Obviously, home games, it's a bit more group orientated as they take their leave around the pitch of Carr Road. So maybe the next away game, if it is a win, I wouldn't put any money on him doing a solo. Whereas, of course, Farker, he loved it and continues to love it. We saw him at Leeds quite recently, sadly, from a Norwich perspective. But, maybe it comes down to the characters and the personalities of the individuals involved. But, to quote the man himself, I hated doing it, so I can't see him willingly wanting to do it again. Maybe we'll set a challenge when they get promoted at the end of the season, then you can do it again.
I think if Norwich beat Derby next weekend, he's going to find a lot of people are going to want him to do that. I would suggest. Now he's done it once, but there we go. Let's see how much he can resist.
I've got a solution, Connor. Send Glenn on. Out. Glenn's the sort of
Glenn would do it, wouldn't he?
Glenn would do that all day long. He could get his gold suit. Glenn could get his gold suit and do it as well.
And the cigars, yeah, he'd love that. That would be great. That would be great. But I think it is. As much as he didn't like to do it, it is probably a recognition of maybe how Norwich fans are taking to him and what he's trying to do as well. Sam, one other note around the game before we go on to transfer stuff. Jose Cordoba wasn't in the matchday squad. I think we assumed because there's been a few sort of issues with his knee in recent days and recent weeks and months probably as well, that was fitness related. And it turns out it was a disciplinary issue. Overslept, missed the team meeting on Friday. We've all been there. It all happens at some stage to us all. It's a real no-no from a football perspective. And you can understand why. And I guess the probably point that to take out of it is, and maybe hinges on to that last point, Yohannes off tore up in his standards, because I think it would have been easy, the injury crisis that Norwich are in, the lack of options that they've got, to say, yeah, all right, it's not really acceptable, but you come with us and you don't, because actually they brought Brad Hills on. They probably could have done with a Jose Cordoba in those moments to see out a game. But I think the fact that he opted to retain those high standards was probably a really important message to send to the group, particularly in light of everything that happened, obviously, in the summer and around the opening day of the season.
Indeed, and I think it's probably fair to highlight that without going into detail, Torup did suggest that there was maybe some sort of explanatory circumstance behind it. Although, yeah, as you said, it's a good example to set, really, and it's a good point in terms of the fact that it's Jose Cordoba. It's in an area at a time when Norwich maybe do have to deal with a lot of those injuries. And it's quite easy to do that if it's, a young player who's at best going to play 10 minutes off the bench. If it's an Adam Eder, even in the summer, when I think everyone expected him to leave regardless, either way, he was probably second or third choice striker at the club. And it's only a pre-season friendly when ultimately, results don't really matter. To actually have one of your best centre-backs and somebody who I think we've seen throughout the season is somebody Torup really, really rates and really wants in his team when circumstances allow. For him to leave him out of the squad, I think does send quite a serious message going into what was quite an important game. So, yeah, going forward, it is encouraging to see those sorts of steps towards creating a positive culture behind the scenes, because as much as obviously the quality on the pitch decides almost everything, I think we actually saw early on in sort of the Farker era and in previous times at the club as well, that culture behind the scenes is so important. And it actually feels like something that joins quite a lot of these clubs who are able to do what Norwich are aiming to do in the importance of culture. And actually, I was listening to or watching an interview with Thomas Frank the other day that Gary Lineker did, quite a good watch actually. And he spoke about how important that culture had been consistently over his success at Brentford. And I think when you look at Norwich and the model that they're trying to have success within, the culture is really, really important. And obviously incidents like yesterday's with Jose Cordoba, they give you the opportunity to both internally and externally set your expectations. So I think the fact that Norwich won probably makes it a lot easier for Torup to take some credit out of that. But either way, I think you do have to give him props for making that decision. And what must have been quite a tough and frustrating decision for him, given some of the context. So, it felt to me like a good example to set. And to be honest, Cordoba seems like the sort of character who will learn from it and is unlikely to do it again. So, yeah, overall, given the fact that Norwich were able to get that win over the line, Brad Hill's got a few minutes that maybe he wouldn't have done otherwise, it felt like actually something that Norwich can turn into a positive, even if probably on Friday night it was something that Torup was quite frustrated about.
Yeah, indeed. And again, the element I like of it is like you come in on Monday and it's done. It doesn't need to sort of be opened up again. And yeah, without sort of obviously knowing Jose Cordoba's reasoning, it's hard to sort of really make it and put it into context, but clearly served the punishment of it. And someone with a five-year-old, I'm sure Pad can agree with two of his own, there are, you know, the children are a reason to want to sleep more than anything else, really. So who knows why that is, but hopefully he's back involved next weekend and can contribute. Paddy, let's move on then to the transfer window. We've got a day left, which is good from our perspective, because it would be nice to sort of, not that it's been a manic January by all accounts, but it is sort of three ins at the moment, could potentially be four by the end of play tomorrow. What are you anticipating from the final 24 or so hours of this transfer window from a Norwich City perspective? Because it feels like there's movement inwards and outwards.
Yeah, I think it's quite clear they're settling in that central defensive area, and I think it probably will be one in, one out. Obviously, below that, there may be some development movement. Ken Abbo was on the bench yesterday, didn't get on again. So he, in terms of the registration elements, he could go out on loan again. I don't think there was anything particularly close on Saturday when I checked in with the relevant individuals, but you could see scenarios where, because obviously Football League loan, that doesn't require a huge amount of logistical plates to be spun for that to happen. So below first team level, maybe a little bit, but at first team level, yeah, it would seem that the way Johannes has framed it now, since we were all down there on Friday pre-Watford, was that they'd like to do something. And by bringing one in, as he said, to create a space, you probably need to let maybe one, and that would seem to be Brad Hills, go out and get some loan football with a view to, you know, coming back next summer and pushing his claims again. And we see the names that are linked. You know, we've got the Peterborough lad, Fernandez, not Hernandez, as I said he was to Johannes after the game. I think I was still stunned by Tom Cleverley's performance, really. That and asking about Onel, who we haven't touched on but was unavailable with a knee issue. But it is definitely Fernandez and Emmanuel. His answer to me was, you know, it wasn't, I don't talk about other teams' players, which is what he said that Tom Cleverley shouldn't have done. I mean, he was like, yeah, I like him. He's a very good defender. And we're of course, aware of him. So when you hear that, it tells you that there are moves afoot. And he is certainly one on the list, which is what we understand to be the case. Also, it would appear after the game, you know, I think Football Insider put the name out there, but we've checked it. And yeah, the Brighton lad, Rory McConville, Northern Ireland international teenager, I think he is, still made his senior debut for Brighton in the recent FA Cup win here for Brighton at Carr Road. They've gone and paid serious money for Aaron Cashin, Brighton, just before the weekend. So that there's obviously maybe their centre-backs at Brighton, they're stockpiling, and they would willingly let him go out. It's a bit unclear, really, whether that would be with a view to being a loan or a permanent, because his contractual status would suggest he's out of contract at the end of the season. I'm surprised by that, because I remember Fabian Hörsler, the Brighton manager, when he was asked about McConville after the game here at Carr Road, and he spoke in glowing terms about he was the next one who'd come out of that academy pot. So maybe there are talks in terms of a new deal with him in terms of the Brighton, and this is very much simply just go out and get some loan football. But he's another one they've looked at, as we understand it. So it feels like they've got players of a central defensive nature. They would maybe like to bring one in, and by doing that, it would facilitate a Brad Hills going out. And, you know, there's been talk of Stockport and maybe one or two other clubs lower down. Yanis said that there has been lower down the Football League ladder interest in some of their younger players. So really, yeah, it feels everything's pointing to one in, one out. And, you know, do that with our hands, which doesn't really work on audio, but sort of, you know, that is it. Good night. And we'll close the door on January's transfer window, albeit we're now in February, but you get my point. So I don't envisage it being, it's not going to be, dare I mention his name?
I'm not over it.
In terms of it, you know, ticking well beyond the midnight and deal sheets and what have you, I don't think we're going to get anywhere near that. It does feel like it is going to be, and to bring it more up to date, I don't think it's going to be the frenetic Abu Kamara, Cade Gordon type of, you know, end to the summer window we had, which was obviously the first under Napa and Torup. No, this feels very much like they'll try and push to do a centre-back. If they do a centre-back, in all probability, that will facilitate Brad Hills going out. And I think that'll be it. I think that will be it, on top of obviously Jurasek, Slimani permanent deal, and Lewis Dobbin. That'll be Norwich's January business. But for me, and I've written about it since the weekend, really, let's not underestimate the other strand to this, which is Sainz remains in the building, Nunes remains in the building, and Sargent primarily remains in the building. And that's where Yannis said it was at when I asked him, had there been any firm offers or interest in the frontline players I've just mentioned? He said no on Friday afternoon. There's no sense that has moved since. Could have done without Josh Sargent scoring another goal from that perspective, maybe, just to alert potential suitors. You see one or two of these Premier League clubs are desperately scrambling around for strikers. So let's hope we don't have a huge curveball thrown in on deadline day. But keeping those players in the building, now the season is unfolding to be one that potentially could involve a really serious, sustained push for the playoffs. Your chances of getting in that top six immeasurably improved by keeping those calibre of player, because we know Sargent particularly, he is a difference maker. So, yeah, personally, I'll throw it back to you boys, but if it was just one in and one out on the centre-back front, would you settle for that in terms of a good window?
Yeah, I think so.
On top of the other business I've just mapped out, obviously.
Yeah, I think so. I think, like, in a dream world, you would have liked another forward option and, you know, whatnot. But as in sort of central striking option. But actually, I think they look okay squad wise now, and they'll obviously be areas to address in the summer. I actually think the centre back one would make a lot of sense, given they're going to obviously be losing Callum Doyle, we suspect, in the summer. And Manchester City produced a very glossy sort of mini doc on him and his loan at Norwich. I wouldn't suggest that you're doing that over a player that you don't particularly rate. But hey, funny things happen in football, and we know that. I suspect it will be more about other clubs, though, rather than Norwich City for Callum Doyle in the summer. And obviously, you know, Shane Duffy will be entering the final year of his deal. And look, we know the strategy and where he's at in his career. I think it's difficult to imagine an idea of him getting any sort of long extension, as well as he's played this season. He's been tremendous. So it probably does make sense to look for the future a little bit, with Grant Hanley obviously having left the building as well. There's a vacancy, and that in turn then lets Brad Hills go out on loan. They've got Adeboyega out on loan as well. And, you know, this is where I'll sort of bounce it back to you, Sam, really, because I got the sense at Colney on Friday, from what Johannes was saying, obviously the McConville links that are out there at the moment are talking about that being a loan deal. Obviously, Emmanuel Fernandez, who, as we're recording, hasn't been named in the Peterborough squad today, but that is down to concussion rather than anything transfer related, just to be clear. And obviously, I'm sure Darren Ferguson will be asked about the situation post-match. So by the time you're listening to this, there may well be some of those quotes on pinken.com. If there isn't yet, then there may be soon. So and if not, then the question hasn't been asked. But I'd be shocked if that wasn't the case. But it would feel like they probably you would want to lean more towards a permanent option than perhaps a loan cover. That sort of feels to me like almost Norwich lining up their options ahead of sort of deadline day, really. What's your take on it?
Yeah, I agree completely with that. I think from a couple of perspectives, really, obviously there's the Brighton end, and you look at how consistently Shane Duffy and Callum Doyle have played this season. I think both actually have started every single Championship game. So clearly injury isn't really a problem with them. They're two centre-backs who Torup trusts a lot, with Lucy Mahovo performing pretty well at left back and Ben Crezene backing him up. It feels like there's less need to move Doyle to left back. And even if they did, we know how much they rate Jose Cordoba. So the chances of Brighton getting their academy product a lot of minutes at Championship level, if they did send him to Norwich, would be pretty low. For Norwich as well, if they're going to do a loan and probably spend money on a loan fee and wages that are higher than Brad Hill's, and they genuinely think they need that option and that this player is going to get the game time, then why wouldn't they just keep Brad Hills in the building as that player? So it does feel to me like the Fernandez one makes probably a lot more sense for Norwich if they can do it. But then, you know, that's the big part, isn't it? It's doing that deal and getting it over the line with a club who in Peterborough have been very, very good, typically at negotiating good transfers for themselves. We know their reputation of developing players and then selling them on. So, yeah, I think the Fernandez one makes much more sense, especially with that long-term focus that you mentioned. It feels like, although actually right now, especially amid this injury crisis, that's the area of the Norwich team that's actually the most stable and the easiest for Torup to manage. In the future, there are a lot of moving parts, as you mentioned. The Duffy situation, it's not just a contract one, it's also his age and whether, as we saw with Grant Hanley, there is a little bit of a sudden drop-off at some point, or his levels do start to dip as he gets a little bit older. And I also thought that when Paddy asked about Adebuega on Friday, that maybe that wasn't it wasn't as affirmative an endorsement from Torup as I maybe was expecting. So that sounds like one where they're still going to assess him in the summer and they're not 100% sure that he's going to play a serious first team role next season. So, yeah, in the long term in that position, it makes a lot more sense to get a permanent deal done. I also think even in the short term for both Brighton and Norwich, that loan deal maybe wouldn't be the perfect one. So, yeah, I think if Norwich can get Fernandez over the line, then that would be the ideal one. And then obviously for Brad Hills to go and get minutes with a club, you know, in League One, and you look at Stockport, who sound like they're the main contenders, I think they're in the playoff places. So they're obviously towards the top end, and for him to get minutes in a team like that, I think would be fantastic going into hopefully a more serious first team role for him next season. So yeah, a lot of moving parts, but I think getting a permanent deal like Fernandez over the line would really help them in the long term.
And Paddy, to end the podcast, I mean, Sam referenced there the injuries that Norwich City have had. All being well, fingers crossed, all the other sort of lucky charms that you need this week, Norwich City are going to be looking at a better squad next week. Obviously, Mateo Jurasek will join them officially when the window closes and he can be registered. Marcelino Nunez might be back for next weekend. Anis Ben Slimani probably will be back. Obviously, Jose Cordoba will be dropped into that as well a couple of weeks down the road as well. You'll have other players returning. A nice run of fixtures, Norwich in decent form, as you sort of said right at the start. Bring it on, right?
Yeah, well, hopefully, rather than it goes the other way. And why did you even talk that up? You know, that was never going to happen. But it's hard not to feel that, you know, the fact that they've weathered these mini periods of player unavailability and key players out as well. And, you know, those issues that were clearly evident in terms of the squad depth not being there, certainly at the top end of the pitch when they went to the top teams, the Sheffields and the Leeds, that back-to-back week. It's quite remarkable. And maybe, me and Sam discussed this yesterday, maybe it does underline the lack of quality in the Championship, that for all of those adverse currents, we sit here and they are two points from the top six in two places. So, you know, but if that's what it is partially down to, as much as whatever Norwich have or haven't done, then okay, let's go with it. And that should almost, again, reinforce that we know you drop a Norwich 11 into the mix that can contain a Joss Sargent up the top end of the pitch, Angus Gunn at the back, you've got a Duffy and Doyle pairing, and then you've got those central midfielders we talked about. You get Science anywhere near back to the product levels that he was showing before Christmas. Jurasek comes in and shows what he's all about in short term. Cernach kicks on again. So many elements, and you've then got the conductor there in Torup, who it feels like it's coming together now. And we've not even talked in this segment, but you know, the Mahovo and the Fisher development as well. So many positive elements. And it takes me back to actually, and it might have been just after the Oxford game where, you know, Johannes said, look, whatever we are now, we will be so much better by the end of this season. I remember him distinctly. I can't remember exactly when he said, but it was probably in those early faltering parts of the season. You know, whatever we're trying to do and the good things you can see mixed in with the not so good, don't worry, by the end of this season, we'll be so much better. Well, we're starting to see evidence of that. And the only thing that's going to stop them, I think, is, well, barring those injuries that come back to haunt them, it's consistency in performance, consistency in result. And if they manage that, then, you know, they're certainly going to go pretty close. You know, you'd argue whether they'd be fit for purpose if they navigated a path through. But, hey, that's for another day. You know, in the here and now, you look at the teams around them who might be competing for those fifth and sixth spots. And then
Oh no, not at a crucial stage.
Classic, that, isn't it? We got through an hour and 3 minutes.
Oh no, I was just beginning to get in the rhythm of that of that Paddy monologue as well. Well, I was going to end, Sam, by asking everyone, really. Obviously, we're going to do a pod post derby, so obviously we're pressing. Have we got your back, Pad?
Yeah, but I think my battery is about to go. So yeah, I don't know how much.
Will. Let's end with this then. 6 points on the table, 2 home games. How many does Norwich get, Pad?
6.
Sam?
6.
6 for me as well. Let's leave it there. Thank you very much for listening. Thank you very much for watching. We'll be at Carrow Road, obviously, next week for the visit of Derby County. We'll have all of the deadline stuff on Monday as well, so keep it locked to our channels across the day. And whatever you're up to this week, make sure you do it without deploying any dark arts. See you soon.
Coda has turned up the frequency. Buses are running more often across Central Ohio. Starting this September, you'll see expanded weekend service on the east and north sides, including the Easton and Polaris corridors. Plus, there are added weekday trips downtown from New Albany, Canal, Winchester, and Tuttle. It's more service, more connections, and more ways to move across the city. Discover the enhanced schedule at coda.com/service changes. That's coda.com/service changes.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Hey, it's Austin James. If you're like me, trying to live your best life while living with diabetes, you can relate to worrying if you're doing a good job managing your diabetes. I use the FreeStyle Libre 3 Plus sensor to get real-time glucose readings and see the impact of every meal and activity to make better decisions. The FreeStyle Libre 3 Plus sensor can help me live life with diabetes on my own terms, and it gives me more time for the things I love, like being a dad and a musician. Now this is progress. Learn more at freestylelibre.us.
For prescription only, safety info found at freestylelibre.us.